Oblaj za ogo jest już się gryłem, bo nam zgodę się obołupadę, mam jeszcze tak, jak już kosztowy budujesz, nie potrafiłem trzymać. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
So I wasn't at the line. David, do you remember where he left off?
Mark, the second
question.
Usually keeps it marked.
Bottom of page 61, 3-3, Vriti.
Oh. Actually, that's misnumbered, I think. Yeah, 3-2. It should be 3-4, 3-5. Oh! It just arrived. Well, I can just read this. I just noticed this was misnumbered. It should be 3-5 with T.
Yeah.
So we completed
question
yesterday 20. Shloka Nisharanam and the question 29.
Mm-hmm.
And what should be section 3-5? My copy is 3-3.
Well, here is 3-3. We got Vriti is next.
Yeah, but it should be 3-5. If you look back.
Oh, yeah, the Anuman should be 3-4. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah. Okay. So this is a reply. This is a reply that Shukadeva Goswami gives in philosophical summary to the 29th question in our study of the Srimad Bhagavatam, which is asked to Shukadeva Goswami by Maharaj Parikshit. And the reply is, regardless of the qualities or quality of one's desires, one should hear and chant about Krishna. A thoughtful person should accept the shelter of a spiritual master and, taking to the lotus feet of Lord Krishna, fully engage himself in devotional service, hearing and chanting about Krishna's holy name and pastimes. Though different demigods can be worshipped to fulfill one's material desires, demigod worship is not recommended for one who is intelligent. Even when faced with other desires, one with broad intelligence should worship Krishna with great strength and determination in bhakti yoga, for bhakti is both the means and the perfected end. Without worship of the Lord, other worship is illusion. By the association of a pure devotee, even the worshippers of demigods can attain unflinching and spontaneous attraction to the Lord. Thus, everyone, including the worshippers of demigods, will be attracted to transcendental knowledge in relationship to the Lord, where bliss is experienced even in the stage of sadhana, if that sadhana is properly undertaken under the guidance of a bona fide spiritual master. This is a summary of verses 1 through 12 of chapter 3, canto 2, and their purports. So, you recall that question 29 is hypothetical. It's actually not directly voiced in the text of the Bhagavatam, but we've added this question because obviously when you read this chapter, a question can come up in the mind. Why is Srila Shukadeva Goswami seeming to step back? You know, he's been gradually bringing us forward renunciation, knowledge, meditation on the super soul, and all the way through that presentation comes back to the theme of pure devotional service, actually stressing that while describing this process of gradual advancement. And then it appears with the beginning of chapter 3 that he takes a jump backwards into, you know, into the material pool and material subject matter, describing different kinds of material desires. And actually, as we pointed out the other last day, I gave the class, the first 9 verses are giving a very conventional laukika. That was the word I was trying to remember that day. There's the term laukika. Very laukika means very ordinary or mundane point of view. Of course, it's scriptural, but this is the way materialistic people take the scriptures. The scriptures are just there for our convenience. We've got our different desires, and all right, if there's somebody who happens to be free of material desire, then there's Vishnu worship, there's Krishna worship, you can go for that. But most people have in their hearts material desires, so for them the Vedas are giving demigod worship, and what's wrong with that? That's also the path of Dharma. But then Shukadeva Goswami goes on to repudiate that. He makes it very clear by using the terminology udaradi, which means a broader intelligence. So what he's telling Maharishi Parikshit is what I've just been saying, even though I've, in those first 9 verses, he comes back to worship of the Supreme Lord, Supreme Personality of God, but then he puts even a condition on that. For those who desire liberation, for those who have no material desires, they may worship the Supreme Lord. And then he goes on to say, but if you want to preserve your family, you know, status and importance, then you should worship the Pitris, and if you want to conquer the world, expand your influence, you should, he even says, after mentioning this Vishnu worship, he mentions worship of the demons, and, you know, so that's all within the first 9 verses. But then, by this term udaradi, he's actually saying, indicating that what I presented before is the point of view or the understanding of those who do not intelligently approach the Vedic scriptures. And this is why we are stressing again that there is a system, a pre-established system given by Vyasadeva from the very start. This Vedantic method of understanding the Vedic scriptures, which means that from the beginning of our study, we learn that all of this Vedic knowledge is coming to one point. That's the Vedantic level of understanding. That there is actually one goal, one object, one prayojan, one necessity, one thing we must do. And the Bhagavatam is Srila Vyasadeva's natural commentary on Vedanta. So here Shukadeva Goswami is, the rest of the chapter, making it very, very clear what that one object of the Vedas is. And he's making it so clear that there's this series of verses Maharaj must have read, in which Shukadeva Goswami is speaking of those who don't take up this process, and how he's comparing their, you know, their senses to ears to snake holes, and their eyes to peacock feathers, and they may have a big crown on their head or a big turban, signifying their importance in the material world, but that crown becomes a it's called bhara, a heavy weight, heavy load. It just pushes them down. So in so many ways, he's actually condemning. He's openly condemning those very same persons that in the first 9 verses of the chapter he seems to give some allowance for. And yes, you know, they can do these different kinds of worship. But by the end of the chapter, he's straight across the board, more or less saying they're hellbound. Because this following of materialistic dharma, worship of the demigods, it's already been sufficiently explained. It does not purify the heart. And because it doesn't do that, therefore, no matter what one's appearance may be, you know, apparent importance or apparent elevation, the impure heart is going to get the best of that person. And he or she will be pushed, forced down by the material modes of nature. And as we go through Srimad Bhagavatam, of course, as Srimad Bhagavatam, these first 2 cantos in particular, we've talked about this before, there's not so much. There is some lila, but not so much. More emphasis on philosophy. But as we go further and further, canto 3, 4, 5, then more and more narrative is presented, and the narrative, along with the philosophy, is illustrating to us this principle, that those who don't take up the worship of the Lord, and they will, despite whatever material advantage or exalted position they may be in, they risk being classified as demons, as asuras. And we'll see already in the next canto, Hiranyaksha, and his fight with Lord Varahadev will be elaborately described there. So Hiranyaksha is the brother of Hiranyakashipu. Both are brahmanas, both very learned, but both are demons because they're opposed to the Lord. So this Srimad Bhagavatam is actually, with these purifying words spoken by Shukadeva Goswami, is actually this is sadhu kata. So he's drawing the line. He's cutting. It's like a knife blade cutting, revealing the difference between the devotees and the non-devotees. And Prabhupada actually said, this also occurs as a result of the presence of the Krishna consciousness movement. For example, in the 9th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, just at the end, just prior to the beginning of the 10th canto, he gives an elaborate purport on this point. That the presence of the Krishna consciousness movement in this world, it's like when Lord Krishna was in the womb of Mother Yashoda. And already at that time, even at that time, the division, just by the presence, even the Lord was not yet manifesting. Of course, this is a pastime too, when he enters the womb, but just by being within the womb of Mother Yashoda, you already saw Kamsa. You see, Kamsa, he had heard that the Lord was coming, and he began his depredations. His demoniac activities increased, and he began to make alliances with other demoniac kings. So the line was drawn already then. So that is happening from the very beginning of Srimad Bhagavatam. And here, in this chapter in particular, Shukadeva Goswami very clearly drawing that line.
Means what needs to be, how do you say, needs to be understood is that the personal is always superior to the impersonal. So the Upasana Kanda is actually superior to the impersonal path because of the concept of having individuals that interact with each other, and by that interaction you get a favorable result. Right? That is beneficial for both. Does that make sense? Because that's what goes on in the spiritual world. You have God, you have the devotees, and they interact with each other. So, therefore, then, though we see that jnana is higher than karma, and is classified because of the element of the renunciation, that you're giving up material endeavor, that will get you out of the material world. So that makes it superior. But we see that it's only superior up to the point of liberation. But beyond liberation, then again, the personal is superior. Right? So now, in this, then what we see is the impersonal becomes that boundary between the two. Right? You have the spiritual world, you have the material world. And in between you have the Brahma Jyoti, which is the, you know, would be classified as the, you know, the home territory of the jnanis, right? So we see in the reflection that naturally then the spiritual is high, the material is low, but the jnana is in between. So in the same way as upasana will be higher, karma will be lower, jnana will be in between, right? Because it's the reflection. So in this reflection, then the karma is obvious, because basically you're dealing with the demigods, but it's the ritual that's important. The demigod is not the focus. The ritual is the focus. The mantra is the focus. Right? It happens to be offered to a particular demigod, but it's not what is the... It's not actually a relationship. In the upasana, you're worshipping the... how do you say? The upasana is actually meant to worship the Supreme Lord. But for those who aren't favorable to that, but at least they're favorable to relationships, by operating the relationship, results are gotten. Right? That's better than a ritual. Does that make sense? You know, it's just like you have someone who manages the go-down, so they manage things. It's important, but you can't say there's much of a relationship. But then you have someone who manages people, that's naturally a higher position. Does that make sense? So, therefore, operating the relationship, then, for those who are materialistic, then it comes across in Upasana Kanda as the demigods, which are the various limbs or arms of the universal form. So technically, their potencies are Krishna, but we don't see them that way. So then, it's upasana will look like karma. But the difference will be is now the person is more important, and the ritual is to please the person. Before, it's the ritual, the perfection of the ritual that's important. It happens to be aimed at a person. Does that make sense? So then, but what Sukadeva is very carefully doing, as Maharaj is saying, is that it's very scientifically going through, very logical. He's already actually cleared out anything other than the Supreme Lord. But now he's taking it from the step of worshipping the super soul who's alone, who technically speaking then is an impersonal concept, because God's never without his friends. So now you're taking it from that impersonal into the personal. So now you're going from the jnana into upasana. But so he's already cleared it, so it will be very easy to establish that in upasana the only one to worship is the Supreme Lord. Because we've already established all activities are for the Supreme Lord, all knowledge is for the Supreme Lord, the knowledge, the universe, the metaphysics is the universal form, that is actually coming from the person, the Paramatma. And so now it's naturally another step is now we're going to improve from karma to jnana to upasana, in that now we're going to worship him as Bhagavan. So we've gone from
Brahman. We've thrown out karma. We've come to Brahman. Now we've brought that to Paramatma. And now in this, we're going to bring it to Bhagavan. Does that make sense? So it's very logical. Because you're, in other words, in each section, you're going to have these subdivisions, right? Karma is going to have elements that are not useful for bhakti and elements that are. Jnana is going to have elements not useful and elements that are. And upasana is going to have the same, right? But in going through, when we bring out the elements that are not useful, that doesn't actually mean that it's, it should be confused that, well, we've already dealt with this. No, now we're dealing with it in relationship to upasana. Right, actually worship of the person. Right, we've got it to, don't make the universal form your goal. Right, it should be the Paramatma, the person, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. But in that we see is we're not, he's said we should worship, but he hasn't actually gotten down to the process of the actual interaction. Right, because we have to remember it's Sukadeva Goswami talking. Before, when Sutta Goswami spoke, then we did hear the Lord interacting with the devotees in the first canto. But that was all preliminary to be able to appreciate what Sukadeva is actually going to speak, starting from the second canto. So he started from the gross materialist and then bringing him to the spiritual platform. As Maharaj mentions that purport, was it 22nd? Or that it just takes you very clearly through right up to Paramatma realization. You know, so it's very nicely... Does this make sense? So there's a logic there, and that your is the cycle. Is that, but it's moving forward, but you're having to, you know, you've cleared what's bad, you've established what's good, but when you go to the next level, you have to clear out what's bad and establish what's good, and then the next level again. Does that make sense?
And in the, I guess in this you can look at these desires. When we get to the, yeah, right, at the, waiting for us at the bottom of the page, Jiva Goswami Satsandarbha commentary, we have the these verses, three to nine? Yeah. Yes. All these things that, are described by Shukadeva Goswami regarding demigod worship. We can also look at that, look at what Maharaj has just said from the point of view of these desires themselves. As a reason why Shukadeva Goswami is bringing it up at this point. Because he's, the worship of the Lord, as you say, it's already being already been logically pointed out, but even when we take up the worship of the Lord, Krishna consciousness, I've actually heard you, sometimes you've spoken to different persons in the past, I remember, and you compared the chanting of Hare Krishna, the process, to cleaning, you know? You're cleaning the place you live, cleaning your house. So what is happening? Of course, the intention is to clean. You want to make everything spick and span, remove all dirt, but in the process of cleaning, you actually make the place, at least for a while, look more dirty.
Yeah, that's true.
Because you're sweeping, you know, out from all the corners and under the bed and here and there and all the places you haven't swept for a while. And it's like when Lord Chaitanya was cleaning the Gundicha Mandir also, you know. Even after the devotees had cleaned everything, he found so much more dirt himself. Mm-hmm. So, this is what happens when we take up devotional service. We get so much mercy in the beginning, but at some point we're forced to face aeons, you know. It means ages and ages and ages. We've taken birth here again and again and again and again. And this dirt is there in the heart. In the darkest corners of the heart, exists what's called vasanas, the subconscious desires. And the process of Krishna consciousness is shedding light in those dark corners, showing us, look at this, look at this, you've got to clean this up. So we've got the process to clean it up with the Hare Krishna Maha Mantra, but by chanting, we actually stir the dirt up, the clouds of dirt come up. And so one may become bewildered, you know. Clouds of dirt, as you're sweeping, it can get in your nose and your eyes and make your eyes water, and you lose your sense of, you know, where you are and what you're doing. And so it can be seen in that light too, that Tripitaka Goswami is speaking to Maharaj Parikshit as a devotee and just telling him, watch out for these desires. And you know, the Vedas have given things to hold on to if you have these desires, but these are illusory also. You know, I mean, you may temporarily get some balance, you know, because if one simply surrenders to the desires completely, of course, then that's the mode of ignorance. So the Vedas are giving something, you know, perhaps to prevent you from immediately falling, but if you take that as your support, just some demigod, then that will also be eventually become the cause of your fall down. You see? Because then you're deliberately choosing something that is not Krishna. You've given up the actual process. This is not the abhideya. This is a last, you know, this is emergency treatment. So, you know, when the paramedics come, you know, there's a car crash, and the paramedics show up on the scene. So they do this emergency resuscitation, you know. The guy is laying in the middle of the street, his heart is stopped, and they bring out this, what they call the paddles, and they get the heart started, they inject some chemical, and, you know, just get him breathing. But where do they take him? They take him to the hospital. The business is not completed there on the street. So at best, the demigod worship is like that. It's paramedic treatment for, you know, someone who just had a big crash in their spiritual life. You know. But that's just to get them, like Maharaj says, they don't give up the process of worship. You know, that goes on. But then the idea is, you know, get them back on, get them to the hospital, get them into the sadhu sangha again, get them really save their life by the process of Krishna consciousness. Get them to the emergency room. You see.
There's what comes to mind just on that is also another angle, taking it to a third, is that karma, then you'll put your lower desires aside because of a higher desire, but it's still material, so it's easy enough to do for the materialistic mind to do. Okay, I will give up that, you know, okay, I get a samosa now, that I will get, you know, a full meal if I don't eat that, you know, so it's easy to do. So, and then gyan, you're giving up material desire to become God, but it's still material desire. The idea to be God, to be one, that's still material. While then, then you can put all these desires on the side, and they seemingly don't get in your way. Right? You can perform your activities, your pious activities, or your activities of renunciation, because you actually are giving up a lower material desire for a higher one. So, but it's still mundane. But now when you're going into the worship of the Supreme Lord, into this upasana, you're leaving material desire for spiritual. So when you actually do that, then the mind kind of like, unless it's fully convinced, it's kind of like the material need comes up. Does that make sense? So, because the one thing is, it means it's still material, so you're comfortable. But here you're going into a realm where it's not material anymore. So material needs are not going to be fulfilled there. So if there are any, then those that have been put aside in the other elements of your path suddenly are going to come back. So then naturally then you have to have this out, as Maharaj is talking about these things you can hold on to. They connect you so that you can balance them and bring them in line with the path, but they're still illusory because they still are material. But at least they're favorable, or at least neutral material. They're not unfavorable. Does that make any sense?
Just in line with what you're saying, I'm just thinking that from strata to Ruchi, quite a long way. And if it's the spiritual that we're going for, on the realm that we're not necessarily interested in, the relationship that we have developed within, what is it that keeps us going?
What keeps us going? What keeps us going is factually we for clearness of understanding, we say Shraddha du Prema like that, and we give an order. So basically there is, but we make it like, you know, there's Shraddha, and then when Shraddha is accomplished, then there's Sadhu Sangha. When that's accomplished, then Bhajana Kriya, then when that's, and then Anartha Nibriti. But actually, these things are continuing. That means it goes both ways. Shraddha, when it increases, becomes Sadhu Sangha. When you increase Shraddha again, then it becomes Bhajana Kriya. And then when you increase Shraddha and Sadhu Sangha, then you'll get Anartha Nibriti. When you concrete, you understand that? So that they actually can go all the way through. But the same way is little discussed, but they also go backwards. So the point is even though we're taking what is prominent, it's not, see, it's like, if you look at it, Prabhupada says that prema is mature Shraddha, mature faith. So actually, when the faith is complete, then you have prema. So then one would think, well, why don't we call that Shraddha? Because it's the best manifestation of Shraddha of all the other nine levels. But we call it prema because that's what's prominent, is one's affection for the Lord. It may be Shraddha, but it manifests as prema. And in the beginning, even though the person in the beginning has the minimal amount of faith, but that contemplation of faith and developing faith is actually what is all-consuming to that person at that time. You know, they're having doubts about their material life, they see this devotees, they hear the philosophy, and they're making a change from their faith in material life to faith in spiritual. So that's the prominent thing in their life. Though their actual faith, if you compare it to someone later in the stages, is the least. Does that make sense? So Sadhu Sangha, then you see someone who has that, they want to come to the temple, they want to visit devotees, the association becomes the main thing. Not the process of devotional service. Being with the devotees, they're engaged in that, but it's, you know. Then next comes that they actually focus on following the rules and regulations, being there, doing everything right. Does that make sense? So it's the focus that makes it. So even though, here what we're saying, so the point of this is that we call Ruchi, Ruchi, because that's the focus. It's like the taste of the holy name, the taste of the devotional service becomes so prominent that that's what becomes, that's what you're thinking about all the time. Right? But the so in answer to your question, what drives you on, one is the, you know, the standard is that the intelligence is that we just know, okay, we've tried all this, it didn't work, and this here, you know, gives logical answers, explanations that no one else can give, and we see examples from others that have done it and it's working. But it's still intellectual, it doesn't catch the mind. Other than just, okay, I've had a bad enough experience here, I'm willing to put in the time to get this, but it's still investment, right? I only put in so much money and time into something, and if I don't get a return, at some point I'll drop it. So it's enough to make us work, but actually what's there is the element of Ruchi comes all the way down to Shraddha. So that there is a taste, you know, we do like the kirtan, we do like the devotees, we do like the prasad, we do like that. And so for us at that point, it is strong enough to move us forward, though it's not the prominent thing that we think about. Right? Does that make sense? So there is. So this goes all the way through. Even the first three stages of bhava bhakti, they come all the way down to shraddha. Like that. Because you hear about your relationship, you adjust with that relationship, and you act within that relationship. So on bhava, that means you understand what is your eternal relationship with Krishna, you adjust with that, you act within it. But that extends all the way down to shraddha, where the person hears, I'm the soul, I'm not the body, I'm eternal servant of Krishna. That's still part of Srup Siddhi. It's just the beginning stages. You know, so we'll take that at, oh, well, that's just basic, we heard about that. But that's actually what's going on in bhava bhakti. But in our process, we give it right at the beginning. Right? And then adjusting with that. Okay, I have my lifestyle, and the devotees like live a different lifestyle. And so adjusting my life that Krishna becomes prominent in it. You know, I always offer my prasad, I don't just eat, and, you know, certain considerations. And that I start performing devotional activities within that. I start introducing japa, offering my food, and reading the books. And does that make sense? So those are actually, those what we would take is, that's just basic, what we preach to everybody in Krishna consciousness. But that's actually the first three stages of five stages of bhava bhakti. I think this is in the purport of, the introduction to Upadeshamrita. Prabhupada actually uses the bhava bhakti terms. And he gets this from Bhakti Siddhanta. Yeah, Shravana Dasa, Varna Dasa, and Samarana Dasa. And he's quoting from Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakura. So this is actually the difference, you could say, means this is a very, just completely side comment, just because it came up, just bring it up, that sometimes you may have heard it said that people will say, well, there's a difference. Up to Bhaktivinoda Thakur, there was one process going on in Gaudiya Vaishnavism. After Bhaktivinoda Thakur, Bhaktisiddhanta, it changed. This whole thing of Raganuga Sadhana and Sarup Siddhi and all these things are just dropped. No, they weren't. Up to Bhaktivinoda Thakur, basically, you would do general preaching programs. You know, you would do a public program because people like to hear Krishna Katha. But before Bhaktivinoda Thakur spoke, some Sahajiya spoke. And after he spoke, another one will speak. Right? So they'll listen to anybody. But with Bhakti, so basically, who was coming? We see in Bhaktivinoda Thakur's books, who was coming to the sadhus were very qualified. Right? In Bhajana? No, Madhushan Hasya. What's this? That big novel?
Jaivadharma.
Jaivadharma. Mm-hmm. In there, one of the main persons is a sannyasi.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he comes in the beginning, he's all the way through. And then there's some other babu, you know, very pious babu, Brahmin family. All these. So, and then in his Prema Pradeep, another short novel. This is all two babus from Calcutta going to, you know, search out, you know, some answers to Vrindavan. So we see what's his name? The Kumar in the Brihad Bhagavatamrita? Gopu Kumar, quite qualified. So we see up to this time is that very qualified people we're dealing with. You know, the king that surrendered to Narottam Das Thakura Srinivasacharya, all these persons, very qualified people. I mean, it's like Govindaji Temple was built by Man Singh. He was the commander-in-chief of Akbar's army. So that means, technically, other than Akbar, he was the most powerful man in India. So they were moving in these circles of very qualified. So with Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, Gaudiya Vaishnavism was actually taken to the street.
Mm.
Therefore, up to that point, initiation meant what we'd call first and second. That's one initiation. But what Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, he took it to two, because the Purushcharya Vidhi wasn't being performed. It means the preliminary activities, chanting mantras, performing yajna, serving prashad, what are the other ones? Deity worship and all that. So those are preliminaries to get initiated. So how do you do yajnas and deity worship and that if you're not initiated? That's because you had upanayana, right? You were a dwija. You came from a qualified Brahmin Kshatriya Vaishya family, and you were initiated into the Veda, and you were doing those things. You were worshipping Shaligram. You were performing your yajnas, right? So such a person performing that, then just from there, they go straight into Pancharatrik Diksha, first and second. Right? You're worshipping Shaligram, now you get Radha and Krishna. Does that make sense? So, but in here, then he's taking Gaudiya Vaishnavism to the street. And then when you go to the street, they don't have that Purushacharya-vidhi, so you have to create a Purushacharya-vidhi. And for such people, they're not qualified to have Upanayanam and to perform the activities. So the only thing that can purify them is the holy name. Therefore, we divided that you get the holy name and you identify yourself, you know, as servant of Krishna. Nama means your name of your servant of Krishna. You know, such and such das. So then you take that up, and then with so much time of that, then also then you get the second. So the Purushacharya vidhi of taking part in the temple program is powerful because it's dealing with the five main processes. But you need to stagger it. Does that make sense? So technically speaking, there is no difference. So therefore, we see Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, while Bhaktivinoda Thakur would say, okay, he would define Baba Bhakti within its natural position of the Uttamadhikari in Baba Bhakti. But Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur would take that and extend it right down to the neophyte on the street, so that they could be connected and come up through that. Like that. So no one should be under any illusion when people say that it's been changed. It's different. We don't give what was given before. It's just when you're dealing with, you know, when you're dealing with, how do you say, gutter culture, then you have to, how do you say, you have to give a perspective by which they could be elevated. Does that make sense? So should we read this?
Around question
30. Question 30. Asked by Shaunaka of Sutta. Question 30. What did Maharaj Parikit again inquire from Sukadeva Goswami after hearing all that he had said? Sutta Goswami answers this question in the next chapter. Parishishtam. Appendix, Vinodakam, or items of special interest. Jiva Goswami Satsandarbhas. Anucheda 31 of Bhakti Sandarbha examines Bhagavatam Canto 2, Chapter 3's apparent recommendation of worship of deities other than the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Consult 2nd through 7th purports 8th and through 11th. In two previous chapters, Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapters 1 and 2, it was explained that devotional service is better than fruitive work, yoga, and impersonal speculation. In Canto 1, Chapter 3, devotional service to the Lord was said to be better than worship of the demigods. Yet, in Srimad Bhagavatam 2.2.3.9, Sukadeva Goswami declares, this is why Maharaj has been pointing this point out, because this is coming from the Acharya. He's saying that, you know, even though he's already cleared all the doubts, how is it that suddenly now he's bringing up demigod worship, even though he's already kicked it out in three chapters already, right? We've gone through what? This would be, means he's counting the previous two, so 19, so 21 chapters, three of them, so 1/7 of the Bhagavatam up to then has already kicked out the demigods and established devotional service. So now suddenly, why in this canto, I mean this chapter, would he suddenly be bringing it up? So that's the... One who desires to be absorbed in the impersonal Brahma-jyoti effulgence should worship the master of the Vedas, Lord Brahma, or Brihaspati, the learned priest. One who desires powerful sex should worship the heavenly king, Indra. One who desires good progeny should worship the great progenitors, called the Prajapatis. One who desires good fortune should worship Durga Devi, the superintendent of the material world. One desiring to be very powerful should worship fire. The one who aspires only after money should worship the Vasus. That's funny. only at the money. The other ones, it's like, you want this, you want this, but this one, it says only, because anyone in the money is only in the money. Right? One should worship. One should worship the Rudra incarnations of Lord Shiva if he wants to be a great hero. One who wants a large stock of grains should worship Aditi. One who desires to attain the heavenly planets should worship the sons of Aditi. One who desires a worldly kingdom should worship Vishvadeva. And one who wants to be popular with the general mass of population should worship the Sadhya demigod. One of Sadhyas, Sadhyas are the head of each group of demigods. Like Kubera is the head of the Yakshas, you know, or like you have, you know, Chitrarata is like head of the Gandharvas, like that. They're actually groups of species of life. So they're the head, so they're popular amongst everybody there. So if you worship Sadhyas, then that means, you know, you're. One who desires a long span of life should worship the demigods known as the Ashwini Kumaras. And a person desiring a strongly built body should worship the earth. One who desires stability in his post should worship the horizon and the earth combined. One who desires to become beautiful should worship the beautiful residents of the Gandharva planet. One who desires a good wife should worship the Apsaras and the Urvasi society girls of the heavenly kingdom. One who desires domination over others should worship Lord Brahma, the head of the universe. One who desires tangible fame should worship the personality of Godhead. And one who desires a good bank balance should worship the demigod Varuna. Right? That's the difference between only money and a good bank balance. If one desires to be a greatly learned man, he should worship Lord Shiva. And if one desires a good marital relationship, he should worship the chaste goddess Uma, the wife of the of Lord Shiva. It's interesting that there's differences between them. Yeah, see. Yeah, okay. See, so one who desires a good wife should worship, what is it? The Apsaras. The one who wants a good marital relation is a different thing. He should worship the chaste goddess Uma. You know, it's interesting how there's differences here. Right? But here it's also tangible fame, you know, because everybody gets their 15 minutes, right? You know, but if you want it something more solid than that, and because the personality of God, he's the most famous, right? Yeah. Everybody knows God, even the atheists, right? Yes.
He says,
"Monk
wants
to be
great to learn to worship Lord Shiva."
Here it says greatly learned. Before was who wants to be the master of the Vedas, right?
You're just satisfied?
No, because the thing is here means, notice the difference between these two. One is master of the Vedas means you have all the knowledge, but if you want to be greatly learned is defined by Rupa Goswami as a combination between character and knowledge. The other one is master, who's learned, right? In other words, one is to be a scholar. Then you worship Brahma and Brihaspati, right? But one who actually wants to understand them and be able to live by them, right? In other words, one is Gyan, the other is Vigyan. You want Vigyan, then it's Lord Shiva, because he's a devotee. What is Shiva doing? He's given up the material world and he's fully absorbed in worshipping the Supreme Lord. So that's perfection of all knowledge. Perfection of all realization. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Like that. Yeah, you know, and put that in through the kaleidoscope of 8,400,000, you know, because there's the demigod of the mouth, but then there's 8,400,000 kinds of mouths. So that's why it appears that the material desire is unlimited, right? But factually it's not. It's limited in that it fits into these categories, but basically when you, you know, if you take 33 million times 8,400,000, you'll get quite a big number. Right? But they fit into basically four main categories: eating, sleeping, mating, and defending. So it kind of, you know, you can work it out. You know? Okay. Then in Srimad Bhagavatam 2.3.10, Sukadeva says, a person who has broader intelligence, whether he be full of all material desire, without any material desire, or desiring liberation, must by all means worship the Supreme Whole, the Personality of Godhead. Srila Sridhar Swami comments, here the word akama means pure devotee. Sarvakama means one who has all desires, whether those mentioned before or other desires. And Purusham Param means the perfect and limitless Supreme Person. Tivrena means firmly, naturally, and easily. The devotee's desires are automatically fulfilled. This is explained in Mahabharata. Here's interesting here, Tivrena, firmly, naturally, easily, means what if you're, when Prabhupada says you're firmly fixed in devotional service, you know, then that means it's natural, it comes easily. Then you're firmly fixed, not when you're sitting there still gritting your teeth and still thinking that you're the only one that's got it together and everybody else is out of it and stuff like that. That's not natural, right? It's still, you're still practicing. But if you keep practicing where you relax, then it will be natural. Then it will come easily. The devotees enjoy a great festival of service to Lord Vishnu. They serve him and meditate on him, give charity to him, and offer the food in their homes to him. In this way, they attain a result even the demigods headed by Indra cannot obtain. The Supreme Lord himself said to Sri Kardama Muni, Srimad Bhagavatam 3.21.24, my dear Rishi, O leader of the living entities, for those who serve me in devotion by worshipping me, especially persons like you who have given up everything unto me, there is never any question of frustration. Nimisha, in other words, by worship of Krishna, one not only fulfills one's desires, but he gets the benefit of having performed pure devotional service. The desire is of no consequence. This is a very, very important point that's being made in this Nimisha. See, is that he says, you have given up everything, right? But why is Kardama being addressed here by the Lord? Because Kardama has just done austerity to ask the Lord for a wife. Right? And then how is the Lord has said, you have given up everything unto me? You know, so who served me in devotion by worshipping me, especially persons like you. It would seem contradictory. But point is he only wants to worship Krishna. But he has this desire for family life. It's getting in the way. So he wants to give that up to Krishna. So how is he going to do that? By connecting to Krishna through the proper performance of grihastha duties in connection to Krishna. Then, as the Nimisha points out, one not only fulfills one's desires, but he gets the benefit of having performed pure devotional service. Is that your mood? That's called pure devotional service. Does that make sense? So, in other words, this process is for those who are broad-minded. Right? It's not for narrow-minded people. Narrow-minded people will have a lot, and do have a lot of difficulty with our philosophy. Right? Because, you know, it's like, how do you say? You have to be, they have a particular, very limited definition of purity. And that purity must be externally observable. And if it's not, then nothing else can be right. Right? It's based on some truth that what's outside is a reflection of what's inside, of course. But still, it's wrong in that someone can have the proper attitude, but still not have perfected the proper practice. Does that make sense? So if someone, and the solution to that is constant practice in the association of devotees, not non-practice, not in the association of devotees. Technically speaking, just from, you know, off the record, that is a demoniac conception. Is that the solution to problems in devotional service are to stop doing devotional service. Sounds good to the moralists, to the religionists, even to, you know, the so-called you know, narrow-minded liberalists. But it doesn't actually make sense in devotional service, because the only thing that's powerful that can guide you, purify you, uplift you, is devotional service. And as they've gone to great trouble to point out up to now, that's devotional service where you engage your particular conditioned nature in the Lord's service. Does that make sense? Like that. So that's very, very important. That does not mean that, therefore, if one has all kinds of material desires, that's fine. No, it's not fine. But realistically, you know it's not fine, but you have them. So you deal with them in relationship to Krishna. And then you get the benefit of fulfilling the desires and pure devotional service simultaneously. Okay? The desires will wane and the devotional service will become victorious. If this understanding is there. If it's not an understanding is there, then you'll have trouble with both. Right? You may perform your service for some time, but after 20 or 30 years, then one day as you're driving down the road in your car, then the mind goes, what about me? I've sacrificed everything. I've collected $500,000 for the temple here, and nobody cares about me. What do I have? I don't have a house. I don't have money. I don't have facility. I mean, a new guy in the generation down from me in Diksha is now running the temple, and he doesn't necessarily like me. He thinks I'm, you know, kind of an anachronism around here. And so, what about me? And then somehow or another, you know, you take the next turn off instead of driving straight to where you were going to distribute your books, and you go, you know, look up your old girlfriend, and, you know, all those kind of things. Like that. That wasn't made up. One devotee told me that's what happened to him.
Okay. This is like what Krishna says in the Apichet Suratra verse.
Yeah.
He's saying, as long as the devotee is rightly situated, then, you know, from the external point of view, one may see some contradictory elements. Mm. But as long as he's rightly situated, and who determines that? Krishna says, I determine it.
Wait a minute. We have a little group of guys at Nicaea, and they differ with you on this point.
Krishna clearly says he's a sadhu. And he says he's a sadhu because I say he's a sadhu. He's a sadhu. And, you know, whatever you're worried about, very soon he's going to be rightly situated. That's the conclusion. The desire is of no consequence. Mm-hmm. You see, you know, whatever you're looking at, oh, but he's got that desire or this or that. You know. Krishna says in this verse, that's not going to matter. It already doesn't matter to me. It only matters to you. And very, very soon, everyone's going to see that, you know, it doesn't matter. You know, and where are you going to be? You're going to be, you know, stuck with Vaishnava Parad because of the things you said about him, and that fleeting moment. You know, you're forgetting that material, you know, it's temporary. We're not here very long.
Yeah. I mean, Krishna's been in our hearts this time immemorial, so, you know, for him a few years doesn't make any difference, right? You know, we're thinking, oh man, you know, for so long this guy's doing this, or we'll be doing this, but for Krishna, hey, that's nothing. Since time immemorial, he's been a nonsense, and now he's taken up devotional service, so it's going to be a few. Okay. Came to mind when we were speaking that was the about we're the ones who take it seriously. Krishna does it. It's just like the mist, right, in the morning here. You have this mist. So somebody who is from here and appreciate, oh, it's so nice here, and, you know, nice trees and nice this, and another person is going, what? You can't see anything. There's all this mist. It's just gray. What are you talking about, a nice, beautiful place? So then they're going to be talking about how it's not a beautiful place, and then when the sun comes out, then in a few moments that mist is gone. And then you've been sitting there saying about how it doesn't look good when it, once the mist goes, it's obvious that it does. So it's, let's see. Basically, it's a lack of faith in the power of devotional service and the power of sadhu sangha. Like that. That would be, that's the. What if there is?
What if the abominable
activity
is Vaishnava
Aparad? If the abominable it is Vaishnava Aparad, that's there. But see, the point that Maharaj is making here is that it's between that devotee and Krishna, and whoever actually can help the person, not those who have emails and fingers that can push send buttons, right? It's those who can actually help, that actually are able to relate to the person and bring them forward. Because the point is even in dealing, there's I know our acharyas mentioned it, but I can bring it up from just to show that it's not just us. 7 generations after Ramanuja, then there was some confusion as to particular Sri Vaishnava etiquettes and behavior. So one devotee, I guess, was asked by the community to document. So he's written a book, and it documents basically Sri Vaishnava etiquette like that, and it's followed to this day. So then one of the points he makes in there is there's somebody commits an offense to a devotee. So if a third party then says bad things about the second party who is committing Vaishnava Aparad, they also are liable for Vaishnava Aparad, because it was a Vaishnava who's doing the Aparad. So you're offending a Vaishnava, even if they're doing... Does that make sense? So he makes the point, it's just, and it just keeps going. And if you criticize them, so that's why Prabhupada said you criticize the activity, not the person. Like, he wouldn't say, oh, you're a Shudra. He would say, you're acting like a Shudra. Prabhupada was always very careful about that. You know, there's a mentality that's wrong, the person is fine. What's it? Hate the sin, not the sin, you know, all those kind of good things.
Okay, just, I guess, read the last 2 points.
Okay. And finish. Therefore, whatever desires one may have, one should earnestly, tivrena, worship Yajeta, the Lord. That worship will eventually lead to pure devotional service. That is elaborately taught here. One may just be on that confused, is that it already said he's performed devotional service, and then here it says it will lead to. It means the one is the desire, in other words, the desire is pure, that's what you want, though the activity hasn't come to that standard. It's still counted as pure devotional service. And it will eventually lead to where the external will be manifesting, it's obvious that it's pure devotional service. Who are higher, the pure devotees or one who yearns for impersonal liberation? The answer is given in the words, a person full of all material desires, sarvakama, should still worship the personality of Godhead. That is the final conclusion. In other words, he just sidestepped the impersonals. they don't even get a mention, right? That's
well, one is full of material desires is generally, you know, again, from this external estimation, would be considered lower.
Yeah.
Than an impersonalist. But actually, if he worships the Lord, then he's
higher. Yeah. Well, in Gita, you see that. Krishna says, first to surrender like the gopis. If you can't do that, then take up sadhana bhakti, mm-hmm. which means basically pancharatra. If you can't do that, then work for me, which is naishkarma. Just do service for Krishna, and it's his. If you can't do that, then do your own work, pious, you know, proper devotional activities. Give the result in it. If you can't do that, be a nice guy, open hospitals, give charity, do all the nice pious thing. And if you can't do that, okay, bottom of the line, last option is be an impersonalist. Right? But immediately Krishna then says, but better than that is action, better than that is like this, and he brings it right back up. But still, they're kind of like... But that doesn't mean we don't respect them. Because of the renunciation, even an impersonalist sannyasi, it's our duty to offer respects to them because they're renounced. But at the same time, is, you know, our life members are doing better than the big impersonalists like that.
So I announced that today would be the last
time. Yeah, today's the last time.
Okay. Until
Yeah, we'll open right after after Gaur Purnima. Generally, it depends on how close it is. Either the first Monday or first Thursday after Gaur Purnima, depending on how close it is. We need a few days between, so that would be enough. Okay, so we thank you all. You can continue with your study, and if you, the essays are mentioned here, you're going through and everything like that, or if there's anything previously from First Canto has it been done, you can catch up and all that. So thank you all for coming. Rantaraj Srimad Bhagavatam ki Samaveta Bhaktabinda ki Janyatai Gauru Premanandi Gauru.